It's Friday, January 7th. Good luck unifying America's lawmakers when only half of them show up. We start here.
You can't love your country only when you win.
A year after an attack on the Capitol, President Biden issues a stark warning.
There's no guarantee, and we came dangerously close to losing it all.
And he wasn't shy about who he thinks is the problem. Meanwhile, major vaccine mandates face the Supreme Court.
This is the court that struck down the CDC eviction moratorium.
If you work for even a big-ish business, this affects you. And these protesters are breaking through doors and taking over government buildings. Sound familiar?
It was just the beginning. This just the last drop of the people's patience.
Why a revolution in Kazakhstan is creating a headache for the rest of the world. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. When you look at big American tragedies, everyone seems to be able to agree they were tragedies. Pearl Harbor, 9/11, even attacks like the Pulse nightclub shooting, Sandy Hook. There might be questions over what policies should follow these tragedies, but nearly everyone can admit they were moved by them.
We will stop the steal.
Well, yesterday, exactly 1 year after a mob broke into the seat of American democracy for the first time in 200 years, seemingly only one party showed up to recognize it.
If we do not defend it, democracy simply will not stand.
Let us honor the sacrifice of our men and women in uniform who protect that freedom with their lives.
Capitol Police officers protected Republicans and Democrats from that mob, but yesterday it was mainly Democrats serving them lunch. It was Democrats who held hearings and moments of silence, and with few exceptions, Republicans kept their distance.
Mr. President, how are you feeling about the day, sir?
I'm praying that we'll never have another day like we had years ago today.
So as President Biden walked into the rotunda for what he had hoped would be this unifying moment, he faced mainly members of his own party. And in speaking to them, he singled out one Republican leader as the reason this tragedy occurred. Lot of news from the anniversary of January 6th. Let's start the day with ABC's chief Washington correspondent, Jonathan Carl. John, you know, there's lots to talk about in yesterday's events, but President Biden's admonition of former President Trump was clearly the headline here, right?
Absolutely. And it was forceful. It was direct. It was clearly heartfelt. And there was no mistaking that he was saying that the fault lies really solely with Donald Trump and his supporters.
Former president's supporters are trying to rewrite history. They want you to see Election Day as the day of insurrection.
He had never mentioned his name, by the way. He kept referring to him as the former president or alternatively.
He's not just a former president. He's a defeated former president.
He wanted to put the focus not solely on the actual riot, the event of the day on January 6th, the people that went and stormed the Capitol, but the larger context of the effort to overturn an election, to overthrow a duly elected president-elect.
You can't love your country only when you win. You can't obey the law only when it's convenient.
And one of the more compelling moments, I thought, in his speech was when he was pointing out that Republicans up and down the ballot on Election Day 2020 actually did quite well. Republicans picked up seats in the House. They won governorships.
He can't accept he lost, even though that's what 93 United States senators, his own attorney general, his own vice president, governors and state officials in every battleground state have all said he lost.
But the issue is that Republicans up and down the line, not all of them, certainly not all of them, but prominent Republicans have either echoed exactly what Trump has said in terms of these baseless lies about voter fraud, they've echoed it, or they have not denounced it, have not criticized it, have not distanced themselves from it. And that, in Biden's view, it's a big problem for America.
This isn't about being bogged down in the past. It's about making sure the past isn't buried.
Well, yeah, I mean, you spoke to former Vice President Dick Cheney yesterday. He and his daughter, Liz Cheney, have been outspoken.
Look, I think that the future of the country is at stake.
Right.
And there are moments when we all have to come together. in order to defend the Constitution.
But even if you look at the investigators' details that have come out this week, it seems like there have always been prominent Republicans who did not agree with President Trump about the election, but then stayed essentially silent about him since.
I mean, in those days, and I knew it because I was reporting this on ABC News at the time, Brad. I was talking to you about it at the time.
As for what's going on inside the White House, very little coming out. I can tell you I've spoken to several people close to the president who are deeply frustrated, in fact, horrified.
People close to Donald Trump in those days leading up to January 6th, and by God, certainly after January 6th, were acknowledging quite candidly to me, you know, most of them not putting their names attached to it, but saying that there's no basis to what he's saying.
Newly released text messages reveal Hannity, 1 week before the riot, appeared to warn Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, that White House lawyers were on the verge of resigning to protest Trump's plan to overturn the election.
But, you know, and some of those Republicans came out publicly and put blame on Donald Trump for the riot itself, obviously McConnell and famously Kevin McCarthy.
We all should stand united in condemning the mob together.
But those denunciations feel like ancient history now.
They want to use their majority power to get people's phone records. They come from members of Congress, they're coming for everybody, said. It's kind of amusing to me of how political they will go with this.
So as you spent the last year reporting then, as you attended these events yesterday, and now as you look forward, I guess, to reporting perhaps on another potential Trump candidacy, what did it leave you thinking about, I guess, what could have happened on January 6, 2021 and the future of this country's peaceful transfer of power?
Well, first of all, the thing that really hit home to me as I was reporting, especially for my book, was that we came very close to losing it all.
It had been reported back in January by the New York Times Trump even pressured Pence on the morning of January 6th with a crude phone call. When I interviewed Trump for Betrayal, I asked him about that.
There was a report, and excuse my language, not mine, it was in the report, that you talked to him that morning and you said you could be a patriot or you can be a Did you really say that, or is that a incorrect?
I wouldn't dispute it.
And now we've learned, you know, that pipe bomb that was set outside the DNC, we learned how close the Vice President-elect Kamala Harris was. To if that thing had exploded, who knows what would have happened. So I am deeply concerned. We got through this. Biden was inaugurated without incident on January 20th, peacefully taking power. It worked, but there's no guarantee in this stuff. There's no guarantee, and we came dangerously close to losing it all.
Right, and what would it mean to be covering somebody running for president in 2024 if he runs again, who essentially has said he'll say the exact same things if he loses again? Jonathan Karl, again, author of the book Betrayal, and they're outside the Capitol right now. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, those highly touted national vaccine mandates you heard about, well, they were never implemented, and today they stand before the Supreme Court. We're back in a bit.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
There's been a ton happening in Washington over the last 24 hours, but of course, that didn't mean anything to the coronavirus.
The United States reported a record-breaking 1.8 million positive cases.
The emergence of the more transmissible Omicron variant emphasizes the importance of vaccinations and boosters.
The most important thing that you can do to keep your child safe, your family safe, schools open, is for everybody to be vaccinated. Kids definitely included.
If your head was down, there have actually been a few developments you should know about. One, if you have a kid who's 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, they are now eligible to get a Pfizer booster shot if they got fully vaccinated at least 5 months ago. Other thing that has changed is that phrase I just said, fully vaccinated. Because if boosters are one of the best ways we can protect ourselves from the Omicron variant, do you stop calling people fully vaccinated if they haven't gotten that booster?
For God's sake, please take advantage of what's available.
Well, now the CDC is going to start changing up its terminology. Vaccinated against COVID will still mean you got your first set of shots. That's not going to change. But you will increasingly hear people asking if you're, quote, up to date with your COVID vaccines, same way you're up to date with your tetanus shots. But will anyone be able to fire you from your job for not staying up to date? Well, later today, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear a pair of cases that could potentially affect tens of millions of Americans and whether they have to get vaccinated. ABC's legal analyst Kate Shaw is with us. Kate, what's going to happen later today?
So, Brad, the court today is hearing challenges to two different COVID policies issued by the federal government. One issued by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, and the second one by the Department of Health and Human Services. Okay, so the first of these, the OSHA policy, is basically a requirement to vax or test for employers with 100 or more employees. So this is targeted to big employers, and it actually gives employers some choices. They can either require their employees get vaccines, or they can require them to mask and test weekly.
And I think our view, and the view of many Americans, is that if people aren't vaccinated, having them test once a week is quite reasonable.
Or actually, they can just require them all to work from home. So they've got choices.
This is the thing that President Biden was hashing out in his big announcement.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a Biden policy, but it's actually not a, you know, it's not a presidential order. This was issued by an agency, OSHA.
As your president, I'm announcing tonight a new plan to require more Americans to be vaccinated to combat those blocking public health.
But yes, President Biden rolled it out to much fanfare, but, you know, it doesn't apply to all employers, just big ones. And it doesn't actually require vaccines. It gives a menu of options, one of which is requiring vaccines. And it has medical and religious exemptions built into it.
The attorneys who are suing OSHA and the judges who stayed the rule are calling it a vaccine mandate, but it's not. It's a requirement that employers try to protect their own workers from exposure to a deadly hazard.
Nevertheless, there have been, of course, a lot of challenges.
You either get the vaccine or you get tested or you lose your job if you choose to do neither of the two. That is the heavy hand of government. That is overreach.
So challenges brought by employers, by religious organizations, by a bunch of Republican states. And they have argued that the federal government didn't have the authority to issue this policy at all. So that's the first case. The second case is a little bit narrower. Basically, it involves an HHS policy that requires workers at healthcare facilities that receive federal money to get vaccinated.
I don't know what kind of pandemic it is if they're firing nurses who are willing to work. I don't know. Doesn't make sense to me.
There's a religious and medical exception to this as well, but this one doesn't have the kind of menu of options. If you work in a healthcare facility that gets federal money, you got to get vaccinated unless you have a religious or medical exemption. And a bunch of challenges were brought to that policy too. So those two cases will both be heard by the Supreme Court this morning.
What happens if the Supreme Court just says no? I think that when President Biden came out and said this is going to be the law of the land, big companies have to get their people vaccinated or at least tested, everyone was like, wow, that's big, but I guess that's the rule. What happens if the Supreme Court says, no, you don't actually have the authority?
Well, so these are technically just requests to either reinstate or to enjoin the policy while additional litigation proceeds. So it's not necessarily the kind of ultimate legality of the policies that the Supreme Court is going to weigh in on after it hears arguments today. But of course, time is of the essence with a policy like this.
Right.
So if the Supreme Court says, we're not going to let you implement this policy right now, maybe 6 months from now after the cases have been fully litigated, hopefully they won't be necessary by that point.
Like, what's the point if we're waiting around for a year?
Right. So it really matters what the Supreme Court rules here, even though they're technically these cases are in an emergency posture. But yes, despite the fact that these policies do seem to me to be extremely well-grounded in the law, there is a chance that a very conservative Supreme Court that is skeptical of federal power could find some fault with one or both of these policies. Remember, this is the court that struck down the CDC eviction moratorium. So it has encountered COVID policies before and found them wanting, right, in terms of their legal soundness. So I wouldn't rule out the possibility the Supreme Court sees a problem with one or both of these policies. And, the federal government says these policies will save hundreds or thousands of lives every month. So the government says the stakes here are really high, but the Supreme Court is going to have the last word.
All right, Kate Shaw, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brad.
Now, as we spent the last year talking about what could have happened in the U.S., other countries have been dealing with very real chaos in the streets, with real government institutions falling. And just in the last couple days, perhaps no nation has been more on the brink of collapse than Kazakhstan. Geography 101 for you. Kazakhstan is the former Soviet state, sits just south of Russia. It's huge. And protesters have now taken control of government buildings in its largest city. So let's go to ABC senior foreign correspondent Ian Pannell. Ian, what is going on? Can you just describe what we're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, incredible scenes, really. Over a number of days, they've gradually gotten worse. Began with some people gathering in some cities. We saw protests, then suddenly people are storming government buildings, setting fire to the mayor's office in one of the major cities. We've seen gun battles on the street, people surrounding police stations, forcing the police to surrender, taking weapons, storming the airport. Setting fire to property, looting. Suddenly you've got these scenes of chaos. But it all began very simply over a hike in gas prices. Gas, especially this particular type of gas, is used to power a lot of domestic cars, vehicles in Kazakhstan. They doubled prices overnight in some parts. That brought people out onto the streets. But this is about so much more. This country has essentially been overshadowed by the same man, Nursultan Nazarbayev, for 30 years since apparently they became independent from the USSR. It's an authoritarian dictatorship. Freedom is very limited and people have had enough.
The root of the problem that we don't have any political changes for 30 years.
They've had enough of the cronyism, they've had enough of the corruption, they've had enough of the political stagnation. And this is a super wealthy country. It sits on huge oil and gas reserves and the people are quite rightly perhaps asking, where's my share?
Well, is that what makes it such a big deal to the entire region? Because I get why this is a big deal to Kazakhs, of course. But this seems to have caught the attention of leaders throughout the region, throughout the world. Is it the oil and the gas? Is that why? What is it?
Yeah, that sounds like a familiar argument, right? I think it's about more than that. To the north is Russia. To the east is China. And if you happen to be an authoritarian leader, the last thing you need are democratic protests taking place on your doorstep. Mm. Now, not all of them have been democratic. Some of them have been violent. But a lot of them have also been peaceful, calling for political reform, democratic change. And you really can't allow that to be successful. We saw the same playbook being used in Belarus. And so the president of Kazakhstan basically appealed to Moscow, Belarus, a bunch of countries around that area who are all part of this security alliance and said, I need help. And really, within a matter of hours of the Kremlin saying nobody else should interfere, it was sending paratroopers who were already there on the ground, Kyrgyzstan.
Wait, you're saying Russia has its own soldiers now inside Kazakhstan's borders, you're saying?
Yeah. Russian paratroopers took off from Moscow. They're already down there near the largest city, Almaty, and they are out on the ground. That is remarkable. Although Russia has interfered militarily in other countries like Ukraine, which we've spoken about, this is the first time that it's really come to the rescue of the host government, the president, if you like, the institutions of the government of a country that used to be part of the USSR. The people in many parts of this region have had enough, but the leaders aren't ready to give way.
Это преступление, за которым может последовать наказание.
We've seen horrific scenes of violence. Dozens of protesters killed, at least 12 police officers also killed, and there's a real danger that this could get even bloodier, even more dangerous. This isn't just a problem for Vladimir Putin and his neighbours, it's also a problem for Joe Biden, who's already having to deal with the headache of Ukraine. What do you do? Do you support protesters who are out on the streets and using violence just after the anniversary of the January the 6th insurrection? Or do you stand to one side and allow authoritarian dictatorships to rule the roost militarily? That's a real conundrum, it's a real headache, and something that Joe Biden really doesn't need, when he's got many, many problems at home, if not abroad.
Well, and that's really the conversation that comes up so often when President Biden calls out countries like Russia, like China, is, you know, deal with your stuff in the Western Hemisphere first. Fascinating stuff. Ian Pannell, thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
Okay, we're going to take one more quick break. When we return, don't have a cow, at least for a month. One last thing is next.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. How's your New Year's resolution going? We've all had a week to hit the gym, be more mindful, call your mom more, whatever you decided.
Resolution number one. Obviously, we'll lose 20 pounds.
According to surveys, the concept of dry January feels more doable to people this year. You know, a full month without drinking to detox from the holidays. Last year, before widespread vaccines and after an insurrection, it was kind of a tough sell.
It's like I picked the wrong week to quit drinking.
But another self-improvement trend could have an even bigger impact on your day-to-day. Veganuary. That's right, Veganuary, going vegan for 31 days.
A lot less of us are eating meat. And part of this is due to the rise in veganism and campaigns such as Meat Free Monday and... how do you say this?
Veganuary.
Veganuary.
I think that's which how you say it.
This began several years ago in the UK and has since become more than a handful of resolutions. Entire restaurants have changed their January menus, including fast food chains, with UK's Pizza Huts offering pepperoni pizzas. This year, large businesses like Volkswagen have vowed to offer lots of vegan food options in their workplace, which is probably an even bigger deal. Like, when your employer offers you free food, you eat it, whether you think you'll like it or not. The draw for these companies is not so much about animal rights or PETA, it's about their own sustainability pledges.
The problem with concentrating a lot of animals is that you also concentrate all of their waste and everything that those animals produce. So the state of Iowa, for example, the pigs produce more manure than all human waste combined in Iowa. But there's
And yet in the U.S., despite celebrity proponents, Veganuary has not taken hold. In a recent Gallup poll, only 3% of Americans profess to never eat meat. But just because you do eat meat doesn't mean you always eat meat. And that's what Veganuary organizers are banking on. That if we all cut back on some meat, that would actually be a way bigger difference than a small slice of the population swearing off beef forever. And a 30-day viral challenge is a lot easier to complete than a year-long resolution. Probably be better with Febregvegan, you know, start with a shorter month. Hey, please resolve to give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening. It really does help the show. Start Here is produced by Kelly Therese, Brenda Salinas-Baker, Lewis Millman, Madeline Wood, David Toledo, Jen Newman, Vika Aronson, and Tara Gimbel. Ariel Chester is our social media producer. Josh Cohan is our podcast manager. I'm our managing editor. Liz Alessi is our executive producer. Thanks to Lakia Brown, John Newman, Elizabeth Russo, and Stacia Deshishku. Special thanks this week to Ariel Metropolis, Susie Liu, Mauro Milwaukee, Taylor Dunn, Ali Picorn, and Josh Margolin. I'm Brad Milkey. I'm off on Monday, but I'll see you next week.